It's Thursday, May 11th, and if he's not telling the truth this time, he's going to jail. We start here. Congressman George Santos is arrested on fraud charges.
This is really all about the money.
The first reporter he talked to was our own Rachel Scott. We'll get you the details. Border policy is changing in a matter of hours.
If you get kicked out under Title 8, there's a very good chance you can't try again for 5 years.
But the surge officials were fearing might have already happened. And it was the nightmare hospitals weren't prepared for. Now the other one.
We've had 3 years of COVID. This was much harder by a factor of 10.
Harder than COVID.
Much harder.
What happens when your patient's life is on the line and your hospital is hacked? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. You heard a former Justice Department official say it yesterday. When the DOJ comes at you, they're not playing around. They don't charge people unless they think they have them dead to rights. Well, yesterday, when federal charges against Congressman George Santos were unsealed, legal analysts took one look and said, whoa, like if the feds can prove this, Santos is in really big trouble.
He has already been exposed as a liar. These charges now allege he is also a criminal.
These were not accusations that he lied to voters about his resume. He's admitted he did that, but that's not necessarily against the law. No, the charging documents make it clear this is all about money, about an alleged fraud scheme by Santos to convince people to give money to his campaign, money that was then used as personal spending cash. And while the charging documents claimed he spent that money on luxury clothes, the Queens Republican showed up to federal court on Long Island yesterday in his signature suit and sweater to plead not guilty. ABC senior congressional correspondent Rachel Scott was right there in front of him to ask questions. Rachel, first off, can you just walk me through these charges? Because there's a bunch of them.
Yeah, Brad, and you took the words right out of my mouth because this is really all about the money. And so Congressman George Santos pleaded not guilty to 13 federal counts. This ranges from wire fraud to money laundering to theft of public funds. Inside the courtroom, the hearing was not long. It was just 10 minutes. The judge read the charges, asked Santos if he understood his rights. His answer was yes, ma'am. And then the congressman surrendered his passport and was released on a $500,000 bail.
This is a really important first step in holding him accountable for the unbelievable actions that he's taken.
Now, prosecutors are alleging that Santos concocted this grand scheme to raise $50,000 in donations that were intended to help his campaign, but instead, he spent the money on luxury designer clothing, credit card payments, a car payment, and also payments on his own personal debts. They also say that he pocketed some of this cash. Now, a lot of these allegations were already out there floating around through various news reports, but there was one specific allegation that wasn't really out there yet. And this is where federal prosecutors are charging Santos with filing false unemployment claims at the height of the pandemic in 2020 while he was running for Congress, collecting more than $24,000 in benefits, even though he had a job. He was making $120,000 a year at a position at an investment firm.
Wow. And so, like you said, he pleads not guilty and he's denying all this. And he actually sort of showed up outside the courtroom to tell you all in person that he's not guilty. I mean, can you just describe that scene?
Brad, this was a circus.
Make a hole.
We're talking about chaos. Congressman George Santos was swarmed by reporters from the moment that he stepped outside of federal court. You had officers and his aide and his lawyer fighting to try to clear the way as he made his way down the steps. He was telling us that we were going to trip and fall, that he just was trying to get to the podium to declare his innocence.
All right, you want to address him too?
Well,
you're in front of me.
And when he stepped up to the mics, that's exactly what he did.
Look, this is the beginning of the ability for me to address and defend myself.
And so then Congressman Santos called on me
to ask some questions in an orderly fashion, and we'll start right here. Go ahead, Rachel.
And I asked him why he would apply for unemployment benefits when he had a job making $120,000 a year.
Rachel, this is part of my defense. This is inaccurate information, and I will get to clear my name.
And he told me that this was all inaccurate information, Brad, but he hasn't really produced anything to really contradict what federal prosecutors have alleged.
Well, that's the thing, Rachel. Like, if this was a political argument or like a he said, she said sort of a thing, you might be able to say, yeah, my enemies are making stuff up. You guys should all be looking at somebody. He was talking about the Biden family. But if we're talking about financial crimes, aren't there usually like paper trails to go along with that? Like, I can't imagine the DOJ comes at this with no evidence that they're planning on using, right? How does Santos actually plan to defend himself? Or is it like, just trust me, when everyone has seen him be a proven liar on other topics?
Well, he continues to insist that this is all a witch hunt, that he's going to provide documents, provide evidence to explain that this is all just simply a misunderstanding.
The reality is
I'm sorry,
it's a witch hunt, because it makes no sense that in five months, I'm indicted.
But when you read through the indictment and you see what is outlined here by federal prosecutors, they say that taken all together, the allegations in this indictment charge Santos with relying on repeated dishonesty and deception to ascend to the halls of Congress for a purpose of enriching himself, Brad.
Does he get kicked out of Congress for something like this, Rachel? Like, what is his future in Congress at this point? He hasn't been convicted.
He has not been convicted. And this is probably perhaps one of the most remarkable things, is that Congressman George Santos today will return back to Capitol Hill and continue on just like every other member of Congress.
Wait, he's going to be there today? He's literally just going to show up?
Yep, he's going to show up. He'll likely vote inside of the House chamber. Mm. He will just simply move forward in his day-to-day job representing Long Island. Because at this point, he's refusing to resign. And in order to kick him out of office, that would be a 2/3 majority vote in the House.
When there was another member indicted, I removed committee. I never put Santos on any committee. That member did get not just indicted, but was found guilty. I told him he had to resign. I would keep that same with any member here, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat.
And right now you have House Republican leadership who is waiting to see how all of this plays out in the courts. And they say until he's found guilty, they're not going to call on him to step down.
Yeah, that was the other thing, is he doesn't have to step down because he hasn't been convicted. But Republicans could kick him out of the House if they wanted to, right? Like that's the other option.
That is the other option. But House Speaker Kevin McCarthy also has one thing in mind. He has a razor-thin majority in the House. He really can't afford to lose a single vote. And so as all this is playing out, he's going to be relying on Congressman George Santos's vote as really important legislation comes before the House chamber.
Yeah, and you were one of the first people to point out that there is a bill in the House right now that's all about like limiting fraud of government money. Santos is a co-sponsor of this bill, now charged with 13 counts in federal court. Rachel Scott there in Long Island. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, the migrants the Biden administration has been preparing for might already be here. We go to the border after the break. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Today is the day that federal officials have been prepping for months. Title 42 was a policy that was invoked as the pandemic began to keep Americans safe from cross-border virus transmission. Basically said you can kick people out from foreign countries because they might have a virus. But this quickly became seen as a tool, an excuse for keeping migrants out of the country when they normally have a legal right to apply for asylum here. Well, that all ends tonight, which is why thousands of people have gathered on the southern side of the border. ABC's foreign correspondent Matt Rivers is based in Mexico City. He's in Ciudad Juarez right now, just south of Texas. Matt, what's going to happen today?
Well, it is safe to say this is a monumental week in U.S. immigration policy. And so looking forward till this evening, everything changes at 11:59 Eastern time in the evening. Really, we're talking about changes coming into effect on Friday. What is happening is Title 42, which is, as you mentioned, this pandemic-era health policy that allows the quick expulsion of most migrants from U.S. borders, is being replaced. It's being replaced by Title 8. Title 8 was the existing immigration law that existed for a long time before the pandemic. Basically, Title 42 replaced Title 8. What is Title 8 in a nutshell? It is an incredibly long list of things that I won't get into because we will lose all of our listeners. I think it's that boring. But the headline would basically be that if you come to the United States and you have what's called a credible fear, you can apply for asylum. You get an interview with an immigration official. They listen to your basically an application saying this is why you fear going back to your country, and then they decide on that case. However, if it is decided, if you are an immigrant and it is decided that you do not have a credible fear claim, that they do not believe that you have the right to be in the United States on that asylum claim, you will be sent back home to your home country. That's basically what it is in a nutshell. It's U.S. immigration policy pre-March 2020.
Well, and so I think it's generally been seen as Title 42 going away, it means it's going to be easier for migrants to come into the country. So what are you seeing there, especially on the Mexican side of the border?
Yeah, so it's kind of twofold. I mean, we've seen over the past, you know, year and a half, a remarkable spike in migration towards the U.S. southern border for a number of different reasons that I don't think we have to get into here at the moment. But what it ends up being is that on the one hand, when under Title 42, U.S. immigration officials could basically kick anybody out that they wanted to. And most times they would just kick them back to Mexico. But at the same time, there were no legal repercussions. So if you come to the country, you get kicked out by immigration officials, you could try and try again.
So basically, after the pandemic, she tried for months to get more work. She couldn't get it, which is why she's coming here. Pero esta es la última vez, la última... It's the last time she's going to try to cross.
We've spoken personally, you know, me and my team, to dozens of migrants who have tried 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times even getting into the United States during the Title 42 process. But now what happens is that under Title 8, you can go to the border and you can apply for asylum. And presumably there are mechanisms in place that allow you to do that. However, just because you can apply for asylum does not mean that you're going to be granted asylum. And if you're not granted and you get deported back to your home country, then you're not allowed to re-enter the United States for 5 years. It's a long time, and basically it's these migrants taking a risk.
Right.
And so in something that we weren't really expecting, everyone's been talking about, oh, there's going to be a spike in migrant crossings after Title 42 ends because everybody thinks they can get into the country. Migrants are smart enough to understand the risks that Title 8 poses.
Después de la pandemia, Guatemala quedó mal, no hay trabajo. Yo tenía meses buscando trabajo y no conseguí. Por eso me tocó emigrar.
So basically, after the pandemic, she tried for months to get more work, and she couldn't get it, which is why she's coming here.
They know that under Title 42, they can get kicked out and try again, but if you get kicked out under Title 8, there's a very good chance you can't try again for 5 years. And so what we've seen that I think has surprised a lot of people is a spike not after Title 42 ends later on tonight, but a spike that's been going on for really the last week or so.
Huh.
We've been seeing it here, the lines and the lines and the lines of people that are stuck outside of the border wall that are waiting and trying their best to get in before Title 8 comes back into place.
Huh, like trying to get in like under this kind of weird new deadline. I mean, can we talk about how the administration's handling this? Because the administration says that this won't be as overwhelming as advertised because they're also instituting new rules. Well, one of those rules is that like you have to apply for asylum in another country before you get to the U.S. Like if you go through Guatemala, then Mexico, and then the U.S., like you got to apply for asylum in Guatemala first or Mexico. But I'm sorry, isn't that the same policy that Donald Trump used and that President Biden said was a bad policy? Does this all just sort of become cyclical at this point?
Brad, are you suggesting that there might be hypocrisy in politics from time to time?
Or just like inconsistency at least?
Because there might be. And that you're exactly right, because this so-called third country asylum process where you have to go to another country and apply for asylum before doing it at the United States, that was a policy under President Trump. And then candidate Biden during the 2020 election decried that policy.
This is the first president in the history of the United States of America that anybody seeking asylum has to do it in another country. That's never happened before in America. That's never happened before in America. You come to the United States and you make your case.
He said he was going to make a more humane approach to immigration, and yet he's putting in restrictions here that immigration advocates will say, they will argue, A, it's maybe not even consistent with U.S. asylum law, but B, it's making it harder for people to apply for asylum, and it is almost certainly going to get challenged in the courts. So yes, there is a touch of inconsistency, hypocrisy, whatever you want to call it, but I think it shows the reality of an administration that has a relatively limited amount of tools to deal with this amount of migration all at once. The Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, spoke to ABC News' Karen Travers.
We do not have a system that addresses the challenges of today. Our broken immigration system has not been reformed for more than two decades.
And he talked about very openly, this is a broken immigration system that needs legislative reform.
Yeah, and the thing that remains constant throughout all this is, like you said, the desperation of so many of these migrants and a very keen understanding of what laws are going to be helping and hurting that journey across the border. All right, Matt Rivers there in Juarez. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
At this point, there's a kind of playbook for companies who are hit by cyber attacks, right? You got specialists who negotiate with ransomware attackers. There are insurance policies and backup programs built around this. But while many people can take a day to wrap their mind around how to respond, a doctor in an emergency room doesn't have that luxury of time. And more hospitals are coming under attack with patients' lives hanging in the balance.
We've had 3 years of COVID. This was much harder by a factor of 10.
Harder than COVID.
Much harder.
ABC's Devin Dwyer got exclusive access to one of many medical facilities that have been dealing with this new reality. And Devin, I wasn't aware of how urgent this problem has become.
Yeah, when we think of cyber attacks, Brad, we think about our credit card numbers being stolen, maybe our email login, our patient records at the hospital, privacy issues. But now that's really being overshadowed by growing concern about a real threat to human life. That is the warning from the U.S. government just out last month with a new report that says that these cyber attacks on America's hospitals are now the largest threat to health systems in America.
Wow.
Move over COVID. A really stunning conclusion after they looked at data at hospitals that have been attacked in over 91 cases in 2021 of hospitals in the United States experiencing this. Mm. These are not rare occurrences anymore. And in fact, the number of these incidents has doubled over the past 5 years. And that has ripple effects throughout a community and certainly can mean potentially loss of life.
What is an attack, like what does a cyber attack against a medical facility look like? Because like you said, I'd picture like billing records or something. How does this end up kind of relating to current patients?
Well, a lot of these are conducted by foreign adversaries. And what they'll do is they'll plant some malware in a hospital network that will shut down all the systems, lock them up, put up a warning screen that says you can't access this system unless you pay us a ransom. A lot of times that's in Bitcoin.
My email stopped working. Which is odd, but not, it does happen once in a while.
Was a cyber attack even in your consciousness?
No, I didn't think that was a possibility.
We were in Vermont, Brad, inside the University of Vermont Medical Center, which 3 years ago suffered one of the worst malware attacks in U.S. history on a hospital.
We had 1,500 servers that had been affected by the cyber attack, and pretty much every single computer and computer monitor that we had to be refreshed. Cleaned completely out and started new.
Dr. Stephen Leffler, who's the president of the hospital, was seeing patients at the time and said it had a really significant impact on patient care.
The way we communicate with each other, everything was down. We actually sent some staff to Best Buy to buy walkie-talkies. And we started switching over to our paper systems. When the laboratory had a critical lab result on someone, they couldn't put it in the electronic medical record. They couldn't call the floor. And so we literally had our administrators start going in the lab, standing there, and running a paper result to the floors.
They were shut down for 28 days after hackers breached their system.
It seems reasonable to expect that there would be contingency plan.
We also talked, Brad, to some patients who were in the hospital that day. I met Jess Krause. He had just been diagnosed with stage 3 colorectal cancer, was just about to get underway with what he called an aggressive treatment plan of chemo and radiation.
You just are scheduled to go in at a set time every day, and I got a call that day saying, "Yeah, don't come. You know, we're figuring it out, and we'll be in touch."
What did you say?
I, you know, was confused, of course.
And the alternatives, if you're up in rural Vermont, are pretty slim. It's not like they can get you plugged in quickly just at the neighboring medical center. And by the way, they don't know how much treatment you were actually supposed to receive because those files are all locked up in this attack.
They shut down all those systems. So we had no leakage of any patient information at all. It was tested multiple times, and no leakage of any employee-sensitive information either. But the impact on patient care was very significant.
So really eye-opening to hear these stories and to see it firsthand and to know from the data that this sort of thing is becoming much more common.
And so what are hospitals doing about this? We have the warning from the government, but it's on the hospitals to figure out what to do. I mean, how do you train for this or what?
Well, we went to a remarkable training session hosted by a group of doctors that's so concerned about this. They say every medical school and hospital in America need to train doctors what to do if a cyber attack hits.
What's your name, sir?
Greg.
Okay, Mr. Greg, we're going to move you over to this new bed here in just a minute, okay?
We were at George Washington University Medical Center here in Washington, D.C., and we saw doctors who were in an ER simulation.
Sorry to vomit.
We met Dr. Arman Hussein. He's a second-year resident at GW.
Hi, my friend. I'm sorry you're feeling this way. My name is Dr. Hussein. Sure. You're going to be seen by a whole bunch of people, okay?
Yeah.
They thought they would be treating stroke patients and heart attack patients, and they were. But all of a sudden, in the midst of all that chaos, they were hit with a cyber attack. The systems are down.
This computer's not working. There's like a weird thing on the screen there. I don't know what that's about. And this one's still computing as well, so... Phones, cath lab is not answering, the phones aren't working.
It was extraordinary to see them react pretty calm and cool under the pressure.
Fair enough. We have all the stuff that we need to take care of the patient if he's back here. Okay. Cath lab can't do anything. I have to confess, I don't even know where the paper charts are. We can deal with that later, I guess.
But afterwards, Brad, a lot of them said, man, that is an added layer of stress when, you know, minutes and seconds count in crisis care.
The biggest thing is, like, I'm making decisions with very little information all of a sudden, and that just slows everything down. Because I'm still going to come to, you know, doing what's best for the patient, but it's just, I just am, you know, grasping at straws for, like, whatever information I can do to best make that call.
Yeah, does this cause, like, concern among doctors? I feel like there's always a push and pull between technology and, like, human knowledge, Devin, but is there a concern among these doctors like, oh, so much of our lives are tied up in these systems that we actually don't have full control over at this point, or we might not have full control over? I mean, is this just the way medicine's going to work from now on, that, like, that could be interrupted electronically?
Well, Dr. Hussein, the ER doctor who was in that simulation, told me, he said, we need more practice without computers. There's just not enough time is given to that in the training. So maybe that's one solution to all this, because the experts, Brad, tell me that it's not a matter of if this is going to happen again, but when. And so a lot of the cybersecurity experts for the American Hospital Association and a lot of these government officials are saying, you know, hospitals need to be held to a minimum level of cybersecurity on their networks. And, you know, currently those regulations don't exist. And there's a big push underway right now to make sure that some of those defenses are shored up.
Well, and you just think of doctors as having all the answers. Like, that's the job. And so it's so disconcerting to hear this almost in real time. Doctors feeling helpless or ineffectual just because of this form of crime. All right, Devin Dwyer, really eye-opening stuff. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
All right, one more quick break. When we come back, a potential bombshell that could rewrite your history books. One last thing is next.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. The biggest news is usually stuff that's happened in the last day or two. Indictments, policy changes. But some of the biggest news to break in the world of racial justice this week is something that happened half a century ago.
We want freedom by any means necessary.
King and Malcolm X have often been portrayed as rivals, as antagonists even.
That's Jonathan Eig, who's written biographies of historical figures like Muhammad Ali and Lou Gehrig. Recently, he was researching for his new book about Martin Luther King called King, A Life. And he was looking into this famous interview where King seems to trash Malcolm X.
He said, in his litany of articulating the despair of the Negro without offering any positive creative alternative, I feel that Malcolm has done himself and our great people a disservice.
This was from an interview with the journalist Alex Haley, who was writing for Playboy at the time. King was quoted accusing Malcolm of fiery, demagogic oratory in the black ghettos, inciting violence.
That quote's in textbooks. It's taught in all kinds of classes about African-American history. And King never said it. That's the problem.
As Eig was researching this interview, he says, he came across the original unedited transcript and discovered that King's original quote seemed way different.
Well, King was critical of the Nation of Islam, which preached violence and which preached separatism.
I believe firmly in nonviolence, and I think we've got to learn to disagree without being violently disagreeable.
But when asked about Malcolm, he was much more open-minded. He said that he thought he and Malcolm hadn't had a chance to really meet and get to know each other, but he thought they shared many of the same goals, that they had a lot in common.
This revelation, if true, would rewrite an entire chapter of the civil rights era. It would bridge what had been considered a key divide. But Eig says there's a reason for that perceived divide. It served the narrative of white America.
Dick Gregory pointed out to me when I interviewed him. He said, every quote that you read from Dr. King in the New York Times, every quote you hear from King on the nightly news, it was a white editor who decided that was the quote to use. And I try to remember that.
This could also potentially call into doubt Haley's broader work. Haley, who, by the way, was black, was also the ghostwriter for the autobiography of Malcolm X. But Haley's no longer around to speak for himself. Eig says it's unlikely that the original transcriber just made up quotes that were corrected later, but it is conceivable, he says, that an editor took liberties after Haley put down his pen. That still doesn't explain why Haley would have never addressed the discrepancy, and it certainly won't quiet the firestorm that's emerged. I asked him how he even thought to go through all these transcripts, and he invoked the first lesson of journalism school. He said, if your mother tells you she loves you, check it out. Like, make sure there's evidence for the claim. He's certainly glad he ran down this lead. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.